Okay, and this is the 12th of March, 1954, an afternoon lecture on the subject of simplicity's definitions. The ground that a Scientologist has to cover could be envisaged as being very, very large. It could be seen as tremendous. Often he is staggered by this because he thinks he is being asked to look at all the complexities of existence at once. He thinks immediately that you ask him to examine something that explains life, that you're asking him to look at all of life. This would be on the same order as, let's study an Aristotelian syllogism. Now, if A is similar to B, and B is similar to C, then A has some similarity to D. Aristotelian syllogism. Doesn't necessarily work out, bear out. I have, by the way, rather facetiously stated it wrong, but that's quite correct. Just so that you don't think I'm being serious. Now, we just take this and we say to this fellow, now look, this explains something. And he feels then that he would have to read immediately all the books of Aristotle and Aristotle's natural history and so forth, merely because we have shown him a syllogism. Well, that would be a sort of a buttered all over the universe sort of an effect, you see. A fellow, you show him a basic simplicity on something, and he's got to go look at the whole thing. Now, it's true that it'd be an interesting thing to trace through how everything works. This is very much so. But people have a compulsion to do this. And let's get the difference between it's interesting too and having a compulsion to suddenly go all across the field, every place, and into everything. And we'll find when we are dealing with Scientology as it is, that we can take its definitions and we can trace through everything and we can find out all the odds and ends of behavior, and we would actually travel for some time before we connected up immediately with a great deal of philosophical work. We would travel quite a ways before we connected, for instance, with the will and the idea by Schopenhauer. But when we'd connected with it, why, the will and idea of Schopenhauer would be quite interesting from this viewpoint. But we're not standing immediately and intimately upon the threshold of human knowledge, simply because human knowledge hasn't pretended to have extended this far. Many times people have said, this is not known. But we're dealing with many things that people have not even said, this is not known. They didn't even know that they didn't know this. What had to be discovered first was what people didn't know they didn't know. You see, and then you discovered the basic and fundamentals of that. So quite often, you'll find, as you work along with these definitions, you'll run into a spark gap. You know, you'll suddenly, there's a gap here someplace, and you try to get enough spark up to jump it. You say there's something missing in here, or this has to be connected up or in through. You would only do that, actually, if you improperly understood the basic definitions with which you were dealing. Here we find life impinged upon the physical universe and busily organizing it. Well, if we entered the problem at that point, life's problems in organizing the physical universe, we would still be above echelon of previous studies. But we're not at that echelon. We're at the echelon of this is the composition of life and how it goes about making universes or impinging itself upon universes and doing all sorts of odd things. Now, there is the rank of the definitions with which we're dealing. This is life and what its capabilities are in going about this thing. Then just exactly what it is doing, where it is doing it, and so forth, this becomes a much more complex problem. you get yourself stuck someplace down the line of, I wonder how life makes a head of hair. And then you start pitching in along in this level of it makes a head of hair and try to depart from that point for an explanation of growth. And you will make pretty much the same error that's been rather consistently made in biology. Biology says, well, now, what do you know? Here's a living organism. Now let's kill it and study it. They tried to study life by studying dead tissue. Medicine is badly stuck in this. They take pieces of dead tissue and study its formation and say, well, this is what life is doing and how it works. They take the biochemical products, for instance, of life, and then try to study life by its biochemical products. This terrific complexity of biochemical products. Oh, you just can't depart from such a point. Far too complex, not enough organized material, and too much data to observe. Your observation could be assisted at any time by following this maxim. Let's find less data to observe. If you audit that way, you'll audit much better. Let's find less data to observe. If you're going in the direction of finding less data instead of more data to observe, you'll solve the case. But if you go in the direction of more data to observe, we pick up this fellow with a mother fixation. He says he has a mother fixation. We just take it from there and then start to examine and process what the mother fixation has done about his life. Oh, man, here we have a real problem. First place, we've taken a very, very low echelon complex theory, such as mother fixations, and we've taken this theory and we've plowed hopelessly and horribly through all of the ways it has affected his life. I would say normally if you merely wrote up the narrative of a man's life, you would find yourself dealing with at least a billion words. Just the narrative of a man's life, just giving more or less the high moments of one lifetime and its interlocking connections with other lives and so forth. It would be a tremendous job. Any man, for instance, has such a novel in him. You can take any bum off a bench, or any judge off a bench, or any other bum off a bench, and you'll find immediately that you have, a marvelously varied and adventurous story that you could tell. This is a wonderful thing, that this much complexity can result out of a very few simplicities. Well, if you sat down and did what we used to call stenographic auditing, which was to say took a large series of notes on every preclear and took all of his remarks and hazarded where these all fit in to something else and where this all fit in to something else, say, you could just keep at this for years. In fact, you could probably keep at it at least for 2 years at 4 hours per week. That's 104 weeks at 4 hours per week. That'd be 408 hours or something like that. And you wouldn't have gotten any further than a psychoanalyst gets using old processes, free association, so forth. You just wouldn't have gotten any further. But you'd sure have an awful lot of data, wouldn't you? Look at all that data. Now, what's a datum? A datum is, in essence, any combination of symbols relating to any problem. It's any combination of symbols you can call a datum. A datum is almost never one symbol. What's a symbol? A symbol is some energy with meaning in it, which is mobile. That's a symbol. It's some thought that's gone into some energy, and it's mobile. Well, we've collected an enormous amount of symbols. We have this tremendous, tremendous number of symbols. And now, out of this tremendous number of symbols, we are less and less able, as we get more and more symbols, to pick any related symbol that that relates to any other symbol. In other words, it just gets blurrier and blurrier and foggier and foggier. Let's find less data on the case. Numerically, less data. Let's not work in the direction of collecting more material about the case. Let's go in the direction of finding the clearest, simplest statement which can be made of the case. And, of course, where's this end up? This ends up with just a straight look. And, of course, it ends up just a little bit further from that. It ends up with a no. You just look at the fellow and you know what's wrong with him. That's that. Now, there's no data at all connected with knowingness, really. No data. There's lots of data connected with communication. Data connected with communication. No data connected with knowingness. You know what you know, like Popeye, he was what he was, that's what he was. You know what you know, that's what you know. And if all of your certainty is stemming out of data, then basically your certainty is coming from energy. And if your certainty is coming from energy, then, damn it, you have to consult energy every time you want to know anything. Think that over for a moment, and it'll give you the broad span of any case that'll ever give you difficulty. He's consulting energy in order to know. It's just as foolish for him to consult, really, just as foolish for him to consult one of these thinking machines he's rigged up so that he can know, as it is for him to rush around, because it's just made out of energy, arranged in symbolic, interrelated, associative forms. It's to be just silly for him to rush around and ask light bulbs what the day of the week was, or ask the light bulb to rattle off the multiplication table for him. It's just as silly for him to go out and ask the sunlight if he could eat. But what do you know, men do this all the time. They ask the sun to find out if they're hungry. They actually do ask electrical current what time it is. The modern electric clock is counting at 60 cycles. It's counting the impulses, and that's all it's doing. And after so many impulses, everybody agrees on that much time. In other words, he does consult energy all the time to know. Well, let's find out, does he know anything? After he's consulted all this energy, does he really know anything? Well, yes, he does. He knows how to consult more energy. After you've consulted some energy, then you go and know how to consult some more energy. Anytime you consult energy, you can find out how to consult some more energy. This is elementary, because that's sort of basic in the woof and warp of energy itself, that it's got a know-how about it. And the more know-how that you get about it, and the further you go on the subject of it, the more data you will accumulate, and the more energy you will be connected with. Now, a fellow looks up into the roof of a theater, and he sees there that some engineer has fixed up an aesthetic effect which certain clouds drift across the ceiling of the theater, apparently. And while the show's going on, somebody happens to look up, and he sees that there's some clouds that are drifting across the ceiling of the theater. Why, isn't this fascinating? He looks at it. What's the first thing he asks himself? He's living in this culture at this time. How do they do that? How is that being done? Curiosity. That's a compulsive lead-on. That's a super curiosity that just keeps going and going and going. The fact of the matter is that it isn't so much how do they do that, is the effect there. And this he completely forgets to consult. Now, there is such a theater where they've done this, and the mechanical engineering of it is marvelous. Oh, they have that rigged up to the nines, this little air blower there that rotates these clouds and so on. But they've neglected one thing, unfortunately. One thing. The clouds aren't convincing. they really don't look like clouds. They move like them, but they don't look like them. Here, then, is a mechanical representation of something going on, but the individual looks up and he says, how did they do that? And now he's going on into circuits and bric-a-brac and behind the scenes. And what's he looking for? He's looking for a hidden influence. There must be an explanation for it because he will not admit that there is such a thing as a hidden influence. So he always goes towards something. He never gets a chance to step off the track and go into nothing. Consequence, his own dichotomies become unbalanced. He goes towards something, towards something, towards something. There isn't any workman out here that is really working toward nothing. They all are working toward Saturday's pay envelope. They're working definitely in the direction of having more sidewalk. If they're tearing a building down, it's just tear it down as a sort of an impatient gesture so they can put a building up. It's toward a bigger bigness and a more something-somethingness. And they go along this line. And where do you get any kind of a balance then? Because you have a nothingness which is continuing to address the subject of energy and invest thought into energy. So we get thought into energy, thought into energy, thought into energy, thought into energy, and we get our old one-way flow. Well, you got thought going into energy, and sooner or later, some thought's going to come back out of that energy. You can't keep that flow going forever. So here this Satan gets up there, and he starts making some symbols. Very happy, he makes some symbols, and he makes some more symbols, and he makes some more symbols. Probably would go on like this forever if nothing ever happened to his symbols and no randomity ever entered into it. If he never set up a machine to make symbols and so on, possibly he could go on doing this. But the very least penalty that will occur is that sooner or later, he's going to get a flow that is all the way toward making symbols. Sooner or later, as the flows are going to be imbalanced. That means sooner or later that thought is going to start coming back toward a, quote, vacuum of thought, if you could imagine such a thing, thought having no particle. Here's this individual who has kept putting thought into something, thought into something, thought into something. Then he observes vacuums at work and all sorts of things. So it's obvious he has a vacuum of thought. So where's he going to get his thought now? He's got to get his thought back out of the symbols he put it into. This is a thinking machine at work. A bunch of confused energy lines into which much thought and experience has been invested, which suddenly snaps on its one-way flow and runs the other way. And after that, a machine is doing the fellow's thinking for him. Now you come along as an auditor, benign, kind, able. You set this pretty clear down in the chair. And you say, all right, run 6 parts of nothing backwards on a cooperative scale to the upper right-hand corners of the woof gauze. Some simple technique. But he sits there, and what's he do? He'll pull the thought back out of the energy masses. It's a process. It can be processed. That will work. But you're sitting there processing a spectator of the behavior of energy. Why don't you send the pre-clear out to sit in a ballpark and watch a ball game? Because your pre-clear, to all intents and purposes, is doing the same thing sitting in a ballpark. He's watching a ball game go on in which he has no vested interest. He hasn't any interest really in the ball game. He just sits there and watches the ball game go on. All righty, there's a little field that sometimes comes over the sheet of energy which he's spectatoring. You're auditing him, and he's spectatoring. And this little sheet of energy comes over the field and crosses like clouds across the ceiling, and he says, ah, something is happening. So he watches this little cloud go across this little machine, walk off the other way, and now he knows something has happened. Has anything happened? Mm-mm. Nope, not a thing's happened. Yet your pre-clear's bogged down. He can't exteriorize. He can't create energy. He won't make any symbols. He'll unmock everything before he mocks it, just to be sure that he doesn't mock anything up. He's doing all these odd things. He's not happy. He feels rather unable. And you audit him, and he watches the little clouds come and go. And thinks to himself all the time, I wonder how they do that. How they do that. Certainly. Well, where are you going to get with this case? You get someplace with the case, but it'd take an awful long time if you just sat there, keeping him as a spectator of his thinking machines in operation and his occlusions and so forth. If all you did for him was to let him be the spectator, and you sit there and stir him up and run concepts and run this and that. Of course, you'll get someplace eventually. Yes, you'll take out a chronic somatic eventually. Yes, you'll do all sorts of things. Merely because you are arranging and rearranging the energy patterns. Now, the probability is he is sitting there spectatoring, and the fellow that you're talking to is one of his machines. Now, this is a rather gruesome spectacle, isn't it? He's a machine that answers properly. He's had a great scarcity of answers in his life, so he has a machine that gives all the proper answers. It answers him, and it'll answer you. It's very interesting. But if you were to look inside of his skull, you would find him, as Preclear, sitting down, smaller than small, the one tiny corner of the skull just sitting there, watching or not watching at all. And the answering machine grinds on and on and on and on and on. But nothing happens really in the case. Well, there's one thing, really, that will trip on such a case after a relatively short space of time. What'll trip is the Preclear, regardless of what he's being at the time, is the only thing around that really has the capability of being anything. You can't ask a machine to be anything very long without busting it into smithereens, because it can't be anything. And the fellow's liable to go into the deepest dive on beingness processing, the deepest dive of apathy, at the moment when the machine he was using to be collapses, and he has to struggle out of a morass somehow or another and be something, if only a piece of apathy. You have ceased firing on a spectator basis. You're getting him in there as a participant. It's the first thing you want to do with the case. All right, let's talk about basics. Are we going toward greater and greater complexities then by trying to get a Preclear down to the basic beingness of exactly what he is, a thetan, a viewpoint with the ability to create, destroy, make space, place objects, and so forth? Well, when we walk toward data in the Preclear, his mother kissed his father in his presence at the age of 2.6 months in the living room of their home at 226 North Fairborn Avenue in Watucken, Wisconsin, which is 8 miles north of Shenanigan, Wisconsin, which is the birthplace of President Goofballa. I mean, you might as well write up his case history this way, because this is the way his bank plots. And the town was established by the Pilgrim Fathers' emissary shortly after receipt of the news that Uncle Oscar had been shot in Omaha, England. And Omaha, England was founded in 1066 by this very same family, and this makes it very significant because somebody must have been in the Battle of Hastings and so forth. I mean, that's what you're auditing when you're auditing a thinking machine. Associated data. You let somebody sit down and free associate, and that's exactly what you get. Because all he's doing is running a machine. The person that you want to process is watching a machine operate. Now, we have to go to less data to get more case. So, be 3 feet back of your head is your first fastest answer. The guy can't be, then you have to pick up immediately processes which will move him 3 feet back of his head with the greatest possible dispatch and with the most stability. Now, lot of processes will get people 3 feet back of their head, but not stably. You know, they'll be real certain today, and they're dead uncertain tomorrow. So, in moving back toward this, then let's see that the gradient scale of exteriorization runs sort of on this basis. We have the individual at first completely enmeshed and lost in machinery, neurons. He's all mixed up, and he's sort of a half, three-quarters, totally dead spectator of a bunch of automaticities that he's taking no responsibility for. We'd run this back then to a point of where he could recognize where some of the machines were. There's a process that does this directly, merely by asking him to think something over, to discuss with himself and consider the price of elephants in Peru and not come to any decision on the matter, but just keep discussing with himself the price of elephants. Now, we step back one step and ask him to make a decision. Well, he will soon discover he's making a decision in one part of his head and considering in another part of his head. That would actually help locate him. That's a cruder way than beingness processing, but it's a way that can be done. You make him consider something that's strange or peculiar, and then make him make a decision, and then make him consider something, and then make a decision, and then make him consider something, and then make a decision, and all of a sudden he'll find out who's making the decision. He is. Well, you've recovered some of his own identity when you've done this. And you would grade forward with any such process or just straight beingness processing. Your course is what I'm talking about now. You would get him to know where he was. He was in his head. He knows he's in his head now. All right, now we go from there in a direction which made him less compulsively connect himself with energy, which could be, of course, just some more beingness processing, and at last he would realize that he had a capability of not of being kind of where he wanted to be, that he had something to say about where he was. And at that moment, he would be able to exteriorize. Now, from exteriorization, we merely build back more self-determinism, which is what? To give him more of his creative, destructive abilities so that he is able to perform more ably and be freer in his actions, in existence, and to know more. Particularly this, to know more. Not to collect more data, but to know more. Now, I've run into fellows who only had to get on the seat of a tank, look around, start the motor, pull the levers, drive the tank off. This no difficulty. Some other fellow gets 8 months of training on how to drive a tank, and the first time he ever gets it out, fully loaded and ready to go and so forth, all he's got to do is give it more gas to get it through the mud hole, and he doesn't. He leaves it in the mud hole. The difference is the level of knowingness of the individual. Knowingness is aided by lookingness, but is not dependent upon it again. Lookingness is a modification of knowingness. Well, we get him up to a point of where he can know. Of course, about all there is to know in this universe that is immediately observable is space and energy and objects and the relationships thereof. That's about all there is to know. As far as the universe is concerned, but now we take other life and we find out that we have entered in some kind of a hidden influence. Now, what's this search toward more data? Well, the search toward more data is actually a runaway from a nothingness. It's a runaway from the hidden influence. They don't want the hidden influence to exist anymore, and not wanting it to exist, they try to whip it with data. Data will never whip the hidden influence, because the hidden influence everybody's looking for is the thetan inside of or back of somebody else's head. That's the hidden influence. We can directly and immediately isolate that. It's a matter of interpersonal relations. There is something motivating this person I am talking to that I can't get my fingers on or understand. The collective thetans, with this impact of hidden influence, gives everyone the distinct impression that there is a nothingness around some place which observes everything that everybody's doing. And so we get a tremendous gripping belief in a God. not necessarily truth, there isn't a God, but this is where people get their belief about God. And they get it just out of the collective thetans, you might say. Everybody's got one of these thetans, and everybody looks like he's a body. Nobody can see this motivating static which is running him, and everybody knows sort of in a felt sort of a way that it is there. So the result is that we get a collective belief based on very thorough data that some sort of a hidden influence lurks everywhere and is upsetting everything. You see, the colloquialisms like, I don't know what on earth gets into you. He talked like a man possessed. And so on and so on. The search for the hidden influence leads the very unwary along toward data. And of course, the hidden influence is a nothingness. It isn't solved by the collection of endless quantities of data. It is solved by a very few definitions. And then you can have all the data you want. You can manufacture it and make it stick, too, if you have a few definitions. What you're interested in, then, is the definition. You're not interested in the vast amounts of data. You're not even really interested in an enormous number of phenomena, even though they are tremendously interesting. There's the overt act motivator sequence. Certainly, you'll run into that. You'll know it. You'll see it in operation. But let's explain it on another basis. Let's explain it on the basis of a higher echelon definition called duplication. You see, overt act. He hurt somebody. This person wouldn't duplicate him, so he hurt him. And now they're a lot further from duplicating him. They're lying down on the ground screaming with pain. Now this fellow doesn't want to be screaming with pain. He won't duplicate somebody screaming with pain. So there he is, hung in midair on a no duplicate. So this suspends it. He refuses the incident because he will not and is unwilling to duplicate that thing which is screaming with pain that he has just hit. So around we go, and in order to get this balanced out, he, of course, has to be faced by somebody eventually who won't duplicate him screaming with pain. In order to get a duplicate of the situation, we've got to have the other incident in reverse. In order to get him faced again with a proper duplicate and to get it balanced out, it has to be around again. In other words, he has to be the victim this time. Any man who has a victim down, if he's having any trouble with duplication, and that tells you that a person's conscience and all these other things that stem out of conscience, moral restraints, and so forth, depend primarily on an inability and an unwillingness to duplicate. It tells you immediately that they stem out of that. Why? Because the fellow can't duplicate, won't duplicate this person who's lying there screaming, and it actually leaves an obsession on his part on the subject. He refuses to duplicate it, and so he puts up screens against his duplication, and sooner or later, they're going to reverse on him, merely because they're going to get overweighted. He's refusing to duplicate all the time. Refuses to duplicate, refuses to duplicate, refuses to duplicate. Then one fine day, he's in the position where their screens turn around on him. He gets knocked down and hurt. So there's a victor. Now, he thinks this whole thing will balance out then if he has enough victors. If he can just make somebody win often enough to make him lose often enough, why, he will have balanced the whole equation out and it will have been duplicated. In other words, an obsession to duplicate, an obsession to duplicate incident is responsible. First, a refusal to duplicate and an obsession to duplicate incidents is in sequence responsible for the overt act motivator phenomena. Well, good thing as an auditor to know phenomena that high. But the phenomena, let us go down in the phenomena which isn't of much value to us. The methods of implanting let's say the methods of building FAC-1 machines and how to get a FAC-1 incident to stay in restimulation and that sort of thing, that becomes less valuable to us. It's still nice to know, but less valuable. What's the importance of data then, the importance of data, has to do with duplication. Well, duplication is this important. Everybody's so hept on duplication, quite obviously, this duplication, unwillingness to, obsession to, compulsion, so forth. If that's important all the way down the line, then let's take a look at the pattern here and see that in the general human relationships, what activity then would take the greatest precedent? And we find out it would be communication. The graph of communication is C to E, across the distance. The C stands for cause, meaning source point, and the E stands for effect, meaning effect, receipt point. Now, what does effect mean? Effect, in our terminology, could be any impulse or thought at a receipt point. And what would then be, for our purposes, cause? It will be the end for the impulse or effect of a communication line in each case. Now, what's a communication line? A communication line is any kind of a line, existent or non-existent, but certainly a distance, across which any particle impulse can be impelled. Well, then shooting a guy in the head is communicating with him. All right. Falls within the definition. Then hitting a guy with a car is communicating with him. Yep, falls within the definition. You'll find out if a fellow's been hit by a car, he doesn't want to communicate with cars. He won't touch cars. So forth. He will find that talk about cars is painful to him. And so on and so on and so on and so on. In other words, we examine it on a basis of communication. Now let's examine the third dynamic and discover that the social aspects of existence are those which are most trying to people, and those social aspects of existence are, of course, communicational aspects. The genetic line is no more nor less than a communication traveling through time, which has a certain pattern. Well, communications which travel through time and communications which travel across a distance are the same communication. They couldn't be otherwise, simply because to get across a distance, any impulse which is proceeding across a distance from point to point, gradient to gradient, of course, is processing through time. It takes time for the fastest bullet in the world to get from the muzzle of the rifle to the victim or the target. It takes time. So people get the idea then eventually of time being laid out on this distance pattern. And there's a long time and a short time and so on. In other words, distance and time become confused. What's time? The definition of time is quite important because it's a simple definition. It's a usable definition. Time is the co-action or co-motion of particles. How do you know what time is progressing anywhere? Well, you've just agreed on a certain rate of exchange, a certain rate of motion of particles. That's it. That's time. A certain motion of particles. What's wonderful about it is that these particles are so thoroughly agreed upon that you can find present time at all. That's magnificent. How can you ever get into present time? How can you ever find it? Well, you find it because that's where everything is. Now, if you were to stop the clock across the universe in any instant and to stop it simultaneously across the universe, you would find out every particle in the universe had a position. No particle's moving. Every particle has a position. They might be on their way to places or from places. They might be just starting or just stopped. But the thing of it is every particle in the universe, if stopped for this instant, in this instant, would have a position in relationship to every other particle in the universe. There are just that many particles in the universe. You can create and put some new ones in. You can even take some out in spite of the conservation of energy. But remember that there's just that many particles. Now we take one of these particles and we move it 2 inches. Does that make two particles? No. You see that? You've got N number of particles in the universe. And by moving one of those particles 2 inches, we do not get, then, a new particle. But for life and for a memory, it's very interesting that the mind can remember where the particle was. It marks the old location. That, then, doesn't put another particle there. There are just that many particles. All right, now let's take a cannonball and fire it at a cathedral. And the cannonball takes 10 seconds to arrive. When that cannonball is halfway across the cathedral, still standing, when the cannonball has hit the cathedral is just then starting to demolish. Well, obviously, it took so many seconds to do this, and the cannonball traveled across that distance, and this was the effect of the shot and all that. But it's obvious then that there must be something significant, the cannonball. To a very aberrated person, the cannonball he could have a memory of the cannonball being in the barrel so thoroughly that as far as he was concerned, the cannonball was still in the barrel. See, although the cathedral was demolished. So life has a tendency to get out of time. Because it can remember where the particle was. So we get time as a total problem of change of position, of just this many particles. We can remember through our history books that the Santa Maria, the Pinta, and the Nina sailed from Cadiz to America in 1492. Well, to our memory, we paint those up as finished vessels with their pennons flying and their hulls leaking. We can paint those up as finished vessels. And we say, that was yesterday. They are no place now. Oh, yes, they are. They're in two places now. They're in your memory as having been, and they're in the messed universe as particles. Because they were made out of wood and iron and copper and brass, and the atoms of that wood and iron, copper and brass haven't diminished one iota. And it may even be that the wood itself, no matter how badly fragmented or what tiny portions of it there would be, particles of that wood may still be drifting in the Gulf Stream of the Atlantic. Certainly atoms of from those ships are scattered clear across the route. Certainly, every atom that comprised the Santa Maria, Pinta, Nina, and, as far as materialism is concerned, Columbus himself, still exist in the messed universe, but not in the same form, in a different position. That change of position and diversification of form has in itself marked the passage of time. But the mind can remember what the form was and where it was, and how many form changes ago it was. Not how many hours, dates, years, so much as how many form changes. You ever walked into a village that seems to have slept there timelessly? It's just been there a long, long while. There haven't been any changes in a long time. It seems to be sort of lost in time, insignificant changes. Have you ever walked into a city that was building, 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 tearing down, building, building, and you go back a year after you saw it the first time, and it's halfway a different city? You take Los Angeles, for instance. They're dramatizing, changing movie sets. And they tear down Beverly Hills and put up Beverly Hills and tear down Beverly Hills and so forth. And every time you go out to Los Angeles, there's only one thing that's the same, the amount of dust and dirt in the center of the city. When you look over this as change, it's obvious that the place is busy, that a lot of action is taking place, and so forth. Why? How do you mark that? By the tick of the clock? No, because the tick of the clock is an arbitrary measure so that you can keep up with everything. You don't even need the tick of the clock, really. What you'd have to be able to do, however, to keep real time and not have clocks is to be able to look. And better still, know what is the form of particles as they now exist? Now, these particles exist more or less at a uniform state of change, and that's time. But please understand this one about time clearly. You can have a mental image and a picture of a particle, and you can mock up a somatic, a facsimile, of a particle structure, form, as it existed when you observed it. And you can check that against the present time form. But remember, the present time form of this object is built out of atoms, which are a messed universe agreement of energy formation. And your memory of it is built out of your duplicate of atoms, your duplicate of forms. There is a difference, then, between the memory picture and the messed universe. Now, we're not interested, we're not even going to go into whether or not you're putting the messed universe there or not. This we're not even going to vaguely go into. In the first place, it's not particularly useful for auditing at this time. You can assume that you are putting it there every split second. Okay, that's fine. You can assume that you're not. That's fine. Your case will run just the same either way, because the machine that is doing it, if it's being done by a machine, is practically indestructible. All right. Now, so how on earth do you find present time? Well, present time is all time. It's just all time. All the time there is in present time. If time is related to and plotted against the existence of messed universe, atoms and molecules, electrons, photons, and all the rest of it, it's just where they are that causes you to make an agreement with your fellow. It's where they are, and they do have a uniform state of change. So this uniform state of change in itself makes time. Now, man builds up the most fantastic, the mind builds up the most fantastic structures about time. You can do anything with time. In science fiction, for instance, they're always warping space so they can change time. No, they don't. They can't. There are universes in which you can change time this way. But those are universes where you are intimately in control of the particles of which they are built. You have to get pretty well up in control of particles. Best universe particles, no. Before you can shift time around. All right. Why does a person get stuck on the time track? Why does he get a thinking machine? Well, he makes duplicates of all kinds of messed universe particles that were floating away from him. He tried to hold on to them, floating toward him. He tried to keep them from meeting. He made a duplicate of what he was doing. Now, later on, he thinks he's still holding on to the particle. The stoop? He's not. He's holding on to a picture of the particle. And he will process, as he gets worse off, his bank and so forth, just exactly like he was handling so many atoms and molecules, as though they had weight, mass, density, and so on. Because he has agreed that they have weight, mass, density, and so on, he then makes up his particles which approximate them to have weight, mass, density, and so on. But the one he made up, the weight, mass, density of the particle, is totally based upon a consideration. He merely considers that these things he's holding on to have weight and have mass. He can actually hold on to masses of energy which are not influenced by the physical universe. But if he considers they can be influenced by the physical universe, boy, can they be. Therefore, these exteriorization-interiorization drills to teach a man how to go in and out, to teach a thetan how to go in and out of masses so as not to be influenced by gravity. That's the reason for that drill. All right, time, then, becomes a difficult problem only when the individual has mocked up, made facsimiles of, messed universe, atoms and molecules, and when he forgets that he's holding on to his pictures of them, rather than the atoms and molecules. Now, he has to make all those mistakes before he can get aberrated. A terrific number of mistakes he has to make. It's very hard to see how anybody could get aberrated, but they do. Now, he'd actually have to do this, you see. He'd have to consider that these pictures he made were realer than a rock. His picture of a rock, which almost fell on his head in 1066, his picture of the rock means more to him than an actual rock, which is to say, the difference in those statements is that the mock-up that approximated a rock which almost fell on his head has more weight, as far as he's concerned, than one which he's holding in his hands. Now, the one which he's holding in his hands have the atoms and molecule in present time. It's very wonderful, but boy, you, there's nothing in present time like atoms and molecules. If they ever went out of present time, they would be gone forever. It's their agreement amongst their fellows, this intricate system, actually, which keeps them all co-acting, one with another, constantly. And with this co-acting mass, you become associated with it, and you decide to hold it apart and pull it together and stretch it around and do this and that with it. And then when you've gone into tremendous effort, you've mocked up an awful lot of effort to do this with, maybe you failed or something of the sort, you leave that effort right there, and that becomes part of your engram bank. You've still got all of these efforts and emotions and that sort of thing that you have mocked up. Now, you don't have to have these things, and you don't necessarily have all of them, but you could still reapproximate them. You consider that it's necessary to reapproximate these things. When you do, you get a somatic. You see, you have the potential and capability of being able to mock up any facsimile which you hold instantly. And you can actually unmock any facsimile which you hold instantly. And all evidence points to the fact that you create them, have to recreate them continually in order to have them at all. How this factor can make anybody aberrated is very hard to understand. But yet we manage it. And we manage it because we think experience needs a ring turned backwards or a string around your finger or something. The way you used to go to the store and try a string around your finger so that you remember to buy a loaf of bread and you came back with a pound of sugar. Now, the facsimile is sort of a system of remembering what has gone on by tying a string around your finger. It's a secondary activity. You do not need the picture to tell you what happened. And you start depending upon the pictures, it's gone. Now, there's a little rule runs along through all this. Anything upon which you start to depend, you will lose. You will lose anything on which you totally depend. Isn't that interesting? Why? Why do you lose everything that you totally depend on? Believe me, there's nothing easier. You stop making it. See, this is kind of silly when you come to think about it. You say, well, suppose you were leading up here on a gate, and all the time with this hand, with a hammer and nails, you kept knocking this gate together and holding it up and so forth. You were holding this gate there. Pretty soon you say, well, that's a good, solid gate. There's nothing wrong with that gate. I think I've just been leaning on it here to look pretty or something. Now I think I will lean on it because I really need the support. So you lean on it a little heavy. You say, you know, that's a very solid gate. I just think I'll lean on that thing continually. Crash, no gate. Why? You let go with that hand. You said, I'm no more responsible for this gate. I have no responsibility for the creation of this gate, therefore it's gone. You put it there. Every time you start to depend upon facsimiles utterly to tell you what has been happening in your existence, why, of course, they disappear. You have to know what happened in your existence before you can put a facsimile there. See, you have to know exactly what happened in your existence, and then you make a facsimile. And then you're told by the facsimile. Well, people make automatic machines. They know what happened, but the automatic machine turns out then the exact occurrence And then the fellow says, you know, I don't have any responsibility for remembering it now because that's going to do all my remembering for me. And he neglects this little interesting step. Is way back of the machine someplace. He neglects to put in the knowingness on which the machine is operating. The second he doesn't any longer put in the knowingness on which the machine is operating, the machine can't operate because it doesn't know anything. So his facsimiles disappear. Now, he starts to plug this in. We start to run this facsimile maker as an automaticity. By golly, you know, you can get it up real good to where it'll really send up pictures again. So long as on some straight or other you vaguely know what went on in that lifetime. It's very cute. This is proved by the fact that as you put machines back into operation and out of operation and so forth, they will turn on and they will go off and they will do various things. Anytime you've depended upon something utterly, it has failed you. Because you stop making it. Actually, there's only one guy who can make anything that will do anything for you, and that's you. There we have the great mystery of it. Now, this is not popular to John Q. Public. Not a popular thing at all. You're supposed to say to Mr. Q. Public, God and God alone is butchering you, bud. Hey, you're an innocent, sweet fellow that wouldn't butcher a thing. And the reason you are getting to be nothing so fast is because somebody's pulling a dirty trick on you. And in view of the fact that you're noble and virtuous and couldn't pull a dirty trick on anybody, well, naturally you aren't doing it. You have no responsibility. You can stand at any street corner and sell this but a hatful, the tambourine full. As far as that's concerned, the biggest cathedral in New York full. This is no responsibility. But, of course, if you wanted to control a vast number of people, what would you do? You would tell them they were not responsible for anything. You'd make slaves out of them, wouldn't you? Real cute, isn't it? Now, we have our first problem in no responsibility when you find the preclear being something inexplicably. You say, well, all right, what do you want to be now? What can you be? And so forth. And he says, well, he said, I can be a piece of chewing tobacco. This is real peculiar. How could he be a piece of chewing tobacco? Of course, he must have been the little boy that took a chaw and swallowed it. But he can't take the responsibility for that because he's not supposed to chew tobacco. So we can find him being a piece of chewing tobacco, but not a little boy. And we find him inexplicably, then, a piece of chewing tobacco. And we rack around for a little while, and we find the fellow that was eating the tobacco. The body that was eating the tobacco. And then we find the thetan that was running the body eating tobacco. But you probably won't find it that directly. You'll fish the thetan out someplace early on the track, because he's been dead for a long time. All right. Now, the more significances you look for in the case, the more data you try to turn up on the case, the more you try to read into the case and collect about the case, the less the case will progress. And the more you try to simplify the case, get less data, why, the faster you'll go. Let's not try to find a billion things he can be. Let's try to find the things he can be wherein he's a thetan. Let's fish him out into a theta category fairly fast. Otherwise, we could play this game for an awful long time. Okay, now we have this problem of beingness, processing. We see then at once that a person who is obsessively or compulsively being something has lost his flexibility to duplicate. He has also, to a large degree, lost his space because he's no longer mobile. His perceptics are off because his responsibility is off. He, of course, can't be a rock and still be responsible for being a small boy. This is too much to ask of him. And so his perception is off because rocks can't see. But it's all very, very simple when it comes to actually sorting a case out, so long as you go towards simplicity. And it's a very complicated job sorting a case out when you try to get very complicated and significant about all.